Today is July 11th, 1977, and my name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Commander R.F. Choate. Commander Choate, last week we were talking about D-Day at some length, and I'd like to start off with by asking you, what did you do after you finished your operational association with D-Day?
Well, as you remember from our previous talks, the landing craft flotilla that I was attached to was fairly largely decimated in the landings of D-Day, even though we didn't have that many casualties of our people. We did have a high casualty rate in our craft. Initially, an effort was made to reform the flotilla with a view to, I presume, going on to other landings in various other places. But after we'd done the follow-up runs onto the Norway and northern France, or the northern French beaches, and the build-up of the troops, it was decided to disband the flotilla at that stage, and I immediately became available for reposting. And whereas I also mentioned to you once that on many occasions, even in wartime, the British Admiralty was pretty good in considering people's preferences of where they would like to go and what they would like to do, what type of ship they would serve in. Again, in this case, I was not consulted, but was posted to an extraordinary little ship called the Cape Comorin, which was a North Sea fishing trawler that had been taken over by the Royal Navy Reserve early in the war and fitted with a small gun forward and a sonar set, or an ASDIC set, they were called then, anti-submarine device, and manned almost entirely with her original peacetime fishing crew, with one or two exceptions. The officers were exceptions, but virtually the entire men were the original fishing crew that had been quietly just transferred lock, stock and barrel into the Royal Navy Reserve. And I think I'm correct in saying they were called a T-124X reservist. And this was some strange form of paperwork whereby they were just taken on to the Navy and continued in their same capacity. A coal burner, which was interesting. It was the first coal burner and the last coal burner that I served in, with all the things that go with that. One of the old original stoke holes. Did about, I suppose, 8 or 9 knots flat out. Carried a captain, XO, executive officer, two other officers, which I was one, and was posted to as a navigator. And I joined her in Portsmouth in about, middle of August 1944, and we were immediately assigned to a patrol off the Azores, which was rather an interesting piece of service time, because you remember the Azores at that stage were Portuguese, controlled by Portugal, and were still theoretically a neutral country. But they'd made an arrangement with the Americans whereby the Americans were building a large air base on one of the islands known as Santa Maria, which, matter of fact, is still operating today in a NATO capacity. But there were no well-developed ports in and around that part of the Azores, and so all the shipping that was bringing the stores and equipment over to build this airbase had to unload by barge or by the floating vehicles in an open anchorage. And there were 4 of these trawlers assigned to do what we called a box patrol off the anchorage to try and protect it from any submarine attack that might develop. Mind you, at this stage of the war, in that part of the Atlantic, submarine activity was Pretty far, few and far between at that stage, but nevertheless it was an attractive target, so this patrol was put on it. The other interesting aspect was that we were based in a little city called Horta, and I've forgotten which island that was on. I think it was on the island of Fayal. I have to go to an atlas to check that out. But nevertheless, we had as full participants in a war, working out of a neutral port, the access to the town within a, again going back to memory, about a 2 mile radius from the actual yard, and we had complete freedom of movement within the city. And again, of course, it was full lights and none of the wartime restrictions that you found in England. The diet was in restaurants was easy, food was plentiful, or reasonably plentiful. Liquor was very plentiful and very cheap, as were many of the other luxuries of life that one couldn't buy in England at that stage. And our program was essentially a 21-day patrol off this open anchorage, followed by 1 week back in Horta to coal, store, get a bit of rest and relaxation, and then on the seventh day off again for another 21 days on patrol. And with that sort of system, with the four boats, it kept three of them on patrol at any one given time and one tied up in Horta.
What exactly is a box patrol?
Well, the harbour was quite a large open bay, and with the three of us on patrol, we took a rectangular form of box off the between the two headlands that were sort of delineated the ends of the bay, and steamed around and around and around that rectangle, covering all the waters approaching the bay. And there were the three of us on it. They were usually sort of one, say for matter of interest, going west on a patrol, one going east, and one doing one of the north or south legs on the ends of the rectangle, and gave coverage, I suppose, of the whole area. This patrol line was probably about 4 miles long by maybe a mile to mile and a half wide. So you got pretty continuous coverage of the area with these three ships. Mind you, in those days, the sonar, the Aztec set that was fitted, was pretty short range. But either it was effective, or submarines just were not interested, because although we got a number of intelligence reports that would indicate submarines were in the area, by the time that, or for the time that I was there, no actual attack developed on the anchorage, and none of the ships were lost at the anchorage, although they had been before we arrived. Now, that aspect of my career lasted until sometime, I would say, early in December. It seemed at the time that it was years and years and years, because it was utterly boring. The weather was, in that part of the year, for October and November and early December, was universally lousy. The only concession that the Portuguese had made at that stage to this wartime anchorage was that none of the navigation lights were switched on, and of course the anchorage was blacked out at night. The ships in those days had no radar, and I remember quite vividly that the southern part of our patrol took us within about half a mile of the cliffs, and probably once an hour when you were on watch you were faced with making this turn in towards the cliffs with no navigation lights on and no radar, and steaming in towards the cliffs, then turning up onto the next line of your patrol. And frequently you would make your turn based on the sound of surf breaking at the foot of the cliffs. And I always used to find that in bad weather, a nerve-wracking 4 hours on watch. And I say the boredom, this was a straight case of 4 hours on watch, 8 hours off. And I had what they call then a standing middle and afternoon, so that I was on watch from 12 o'clock until 4, be it in the afternoon or be it in the middle of the night. And you still had a certain amount of daytime work to accomplish as well. And so even though you were on watch from midnight till 4 a.m., you were normally up again by about 7:30, quarter to 8, to get whatever paperwork you had to get done, other record-keeping, personnel work done, the dash back on watch at midday, and you're trying to catch up your extra hour of sleep every so often in the evening between about 4 or 5 in the afternoon to catch an extra hour of snooze. And that becomes a pretty monotonous type of existence if there's not a great deal of excitement to other than the navigational hazards of the patrol.
How large was the contingent in the port, the combatant contingent? Just the four ships?
Or just the four ships. No, there were no American ships there at all. The odd one would come through. I never remember any American ships in Horta itself. Well, the only other ship that was there was one of the old bird-class sloops, not unlike the Stork and the ship that I was first serving in, that had been the victim of one of the early acoustic torpedoes. They had a whole stern blown off. And that had happened fairly close to the Azores, and they towed her in there, and they tied her up, and she was our headquarters ship. The sort of senior officer of this flotilla of four trawlers was based there, and his administrative staff, and they looked after our pay records and that type of thing, and we drew our pay through them. And the anchorage, the America, was all, I suppose, largely victory ships, liberty ships, that type of thing. We were carrying stores and material and personnel, and I couldn't even give a hazard a guess these days, but I suppose anything between 6 to 10 of these craft in the anchorage most of the time, unloading. As soon as it unloaded, they would back off the States to pick up additional gear, and others would arrive. So it was a floating population in the anchorage the whole time. And then in early December, it must have been, the requirement came to for one ship that had been damaged in a convoy and was only capable of doing something like about 4 knots to be escorted back to England. And out of the four trawlers that were working in the Azores at that time, we were selected as the one to escort this thing back to Plymouth. Which, again, would have taken place early December to the middle of December of 1944. I think we were back in England just before Christmas. And the ship was given a 10-day standover before theoretically returning to the Azores. And I go back to a previous statement that the Admiralty was pretty good in trying to listen to one's desires and wishes. And I took the opportunity from Portsmouth of dashing up to the Admiralty and going seeing the gentleman who looked after the postings at that stage of officers, and said, I would like to do something else other than spend the rest of the war in a trawler sitting off the Azores. And I was asked what I'd like to do. And I said, well, I'd like to go to a destroyer. And he said, oh my goodness, you know, the chances of doing that are very remote at this stage of the game. I think it's probably better if you stayed where you are. And I said, well, I'd sort of like to go to a destroyer, and if you can sort of bear it in mind, then that's what I'd like to do.
Why would it be difficult to get on a destroyer at that time?
I think they were having a lot of permanent force people becoming available, regular Royal Navy officers by that stage. People probably coming out of coastal forces and things like that too, at that stage of the game, with experience. And well, of course, I suppose by that stage too, the Mediterranean had slackened down a lot. They were reducing the fleet size down there and bringing them back into sort of home waters. Also possibly, I suppose, that all the training schools by then were really pumping out officers at a high rate of knots. And in any case, he listed my name as being saying that he'd bear it in mind. And I hadn't been back in Portsmouth more than 3 days before he phoned me up and said, you'll never believe it, I don't have exactly a destroyer, but it's what we are calling a captain-class frigate. And we said, would you like to go to that? And I said, what has? And he said, well, you wouldn't be the navigator as a reserve officer, because they have a permanent force navigator, but you'd be assistant navigator and one of the weapons control officers. And I said, I'd love to. And so I found I was suddenly posted to a ship called HMS Rio, spelled R-I-O-U. And these were a class of ship that had been built in the States for both by use by the U.S. Navy in coastal patrol work, and quite a few were built and sold to the Royal Navy. At that stage, quite an innovation. They were what they called a diesel electric. And the fact that the ship was run by an electric motor, which ran the engines, and a big diesel generator that produced electricity to run the electric motors that drove the engines. My guess would have been about 250 to 280 feet, well armed with small, essentially small weapons. If I remember correctly, there'd be a 3-inch gun forward and aft, plus many of the Bofors, Oerlikon, pom-pom type of 20 millimeter, 40 millimeter weapons. And she was, this particular ship was engaged at this stage, or was just starting, really, to do a series of patrols off the Dutch coast. Because at this stage, the German U-boat activity was getting very active again off the east coast of England and off the Dutch and Belgian coasts, and starting to play a fair amount of havoc with some of the shipping that was going over into the ports as they were being liberated along the north coast of France and through Belgium and into Holland. And the German boats, E-boats, were consistently faster than the British motor gunboats or motor torpedo boats, which were their natural counterpart.
Adversary, yeah.
Or adversary. Also, these boats, being either 2 or 3 engine high-performance gasoline engines, were very noisy, and people could hear them coming miles away. So a system was set up of what is now known as sort of surface force direction. But this ship, I think, was probably one of the first to be used in the role. And how we would do it would be to take a sail from Harwich, and we'd go in company with 4 or 6 of our own MTBs, and we'd station ourselves off the Dutch coast and essentially sit there or steam very, very slowly. And the MTBs would lie stopped at night or just with their engines idling to keep them warm. And we had a good radar, an American set, but as the Americans so frequently do, they had taken or used what had been essentially initially a British idea of radar and improved on it to where the sets that the Americans were producing by that stage were far superior to their British equivalents. And we'd sit and would plan and plot any of the German U-boats that we saw coming down the coast or traveling along the coast with the radar. And by controlling on radio our own little MTBs, you could move them very slowly and very quietly into a position ahead of where you could see the U-boats were going. And by talking to them, they'd wait until the U-boats got down within a matter of, probably less than 1,000 yards or so. And then you could tell your boats to, as we just said, start up. And they would immediately go into high gear. And because at that stage they were right in amongst the U-boats and could normally do a fair amount of damage before the U-boats could outrun them and get back and clear into the base. It is also the start of where the commanding officer, because of the radar in the ship and because of the operations room facilities, where the system of the captain fighting his ship from the operations room really, I think, in my mind, started. You look at all the NATO navies now, and the Brits were the leaders in this, where they decided to leave the captain on the bridge, out of touch with his operations room, out of touch with his radar, and out of touch with his radios, isolated the captain. And he wasn't getting the proper appreciation of how the overall battle was developing around him. To do this surface force direction required the captain to be in the operations room, because that is where the information was displayed. And we always took with us an experienced MTB officer, and he would be continually talking to the MTBs on radio, but the captain would also direct the battle. And our particular captain at that time happened also to be an ex-MTB officer. He'd been a senior officer of a MTB flotilla before he had moved across to being XL, the destroyer, and then to commanding officer of this frigate. And so he was acutely aware of the difficulties of the MTBs and their problems in battle and how to try and best position them for an attack against the U-boats. But to go on, just look at all the ships now in NATO. They are all fought for their operations room. The captain will go to the bridge occasionally, but he fights from the ops room. And this is essentially where it started. And the value of putting the captain where the information was, I think, came out of that period of the war and that start of the operations in that area. And you slowly started to see it take over. And by the end of 1945, and into the very end of the later 40s, the Royal Navy was almost entirely fighting their ship from the operations room. The Canadians were starting to. The Americans held back for a long time. In fact, they still haven't even today convinced all their captains that their place is down there rather than on the bridge of the ship. So I found that a very interesting episode.
How effective was the radar that you were using by then? What was the range and resolution, that sort of thing?
Well, I would say the average range that we were getting on MTBs was probably the region of 15 to 20 miles, depending a little on the atmospheric conditions at the time. More specifically, what you'd call a good definition in a radar set at that stage. You could, it would differentiate between two MTB or E-boats that were fairly close together. And instead of showing them as one large echo, we'd show them as two or three or four. And the same with the control of our own boats. You could identify the individual boats within a group, particularly if they were fairly close. And of course, with the information from the radar, this was all set up in our ops room on a major plot. And you could very carefully pre-position your own forces. And our particular captain, being an ex-MTB man, also liked, if he could, to position himself in his frigate in a position where he might be able to lie very quiet and let these boats get in pretty close to him before doing anything about it. And it was arduous. We were working pretty close in on the coast, in areas that were still heavily mined. In fact, out of our flotilla of six craft, I think two were sunk between early January 45 and the end of the war by mines on the way back and forth to Harwich. But we stood a system of there, 4 hours on watch and 4 hours off watch. And we had our duty commanding officer on the bridge, and it was usually the captain or the XO, and I say on the bridge, is either the bridge or the operations room. If it is at night when we expected E-boats, he would be, generally speaking, in the operations room. On daylight, when it was E-boat attack was less likely, but air attack was fairly likely, he'd be, probably be on the bridge. An officer of the watch, a weapon controller, and a duty navigator, all closed up. And so we did four on and four off, and we worked a system of 5 days on patrol, and then 5 days in Harwich. 5 days on patrol and 5 days in Harwich. And by the end of that 5 days, where you'd spent 12 hours out of every 24 actually on the bridge on watch, and then another fair whack of time doing other bits and pieces of work that is always continuing, and personnel work and paperwork and administration work. By the end of 5 days, you were exhausted.
Imagine.
And the 5 days really back in Harwich was for the quiet relaxation and try and get the troops gassed up again and get them all ready to take off another 5 days.
What was a typical encounter with a one or more E-boats like?
Exhilarating, I think, is probably a fair word. The E-boats were a very beautiful design of boat, and particularly sort of in the very early morning, maybe in the sort of very early light or under star shell, the Germans had designed something into the stern of the craft. So instead of running with the stern very deep in the water, as many high-powered craft would do, these ran almost level on the water. And to see them in fog patches or under star shell or in very early light was almost an eerie feeling. Very fast, much faster than most of our craft.
How fast, by the way? Just
We had plotted them on a number of occasions in excess of 40 knots. People had told me that, in actual fact, in many cases, they had clocked up to 45 and 46 knots in them. Our own boats at that stage were probably something in the region of the low 30s, and were, generally speaking, outrun by the E-boats. And this is why this system developed, to give them a good start position in the battle. And it couldn't be done in the same way now, because the art of intercepting, listening to other people's radio transmissions hadn't developed anything like it to the stage that it had now, whereas you could intercept everything that we were saying to to one of our own craft. We did, however, in our own craft, carry one or two people who were fluent in German, and we did know the German frequencies. And so frequently he could, by listening to the German frequencies, could say to our captain, they're about to alter course to starboard, or they're going to do so-and-so and so-and-so, which would enable our captain to make a better appreciation of the enemy intentions. And a typical sort of engagement would go to be when we'd be sitting out, and usually I would say the actions took place sort of between 1 o'clock in the morning and absolute dawn, to where the radar would make contact, and they'd start plotting these craft, establish their course and speed, and they cast ahead and say they're going to be in that in a certain position within the next 15 or 20 minutes. And then by voice radio to our own little boats, we would control them at a slow speed into an intercept position, stop them dead ahead in the track where the E-boats were going, and then if the E-boats altered course, reposition them to always be just ahead, and then wait till the E-boats got very, very close, I would say in under 1,000 yards, and then would. And of course, by this time, our own craft could normally hear the E-boat engines, have a pretty good idea of where they were. But they would not start up or take any offensive action until they were given the word from our ship, which was normally a code word of tally-ho or something like that, which meant you're within striking range. Open up searchlights and everything else and try and illuminate them and get off your shots as quickly as you can. Usually on that, this gave our people an excellent attacking position. If they didn't sink too many E-boats, they certainly deterred them from their mission and did a lot of damage, and sank, of course, a fair number at the same time, because they were in a first-class position to do it. E-boats, as far as I can remember, would usually at that stage break off the engagement. I think they knew that our MTBs for this stage were being backed up by something heavier as well. And as I mentioned to you earlier, our captain liked to get into it if he could. And he would frequently try and move his own ship in ahead of the E-boat position. And our normal one was to, once the the battle with the MTBs, well, they were thoroughly mixed up in it. Of course, we couldn't do any shooting at it. But once that melee had cleared, and the E-boats were either breaking off or turning back, we would endeavor to illuminate with star shell, and if we could pick out a target, use our own weapons to get off a few good shots too, which was what our captain loved doing. And I say he tried to. We were restricted frequently by positions of minefields and limited where we could go. Although that stage, even so, most of the minefields, if I remember correctly, were remnants of British ones had been laid earlier, which we knew where they were, and ones that Germans had laid, we had a pretty fair idea of where the limits to them were, and of course they kept channels swept with minesweepers the whole time, so we knew areas that had been swept, and we normally tried to stick in those. It was pointless. Losing your ship on a mine, or getting it badly damaged in a mine, if you could avoid it, mm-hmm. Because you're then not much more used to you.
Do you recall any specific incidents pertaining to these engagements that might be interesting?
In what sort of way?
Oh, it's sort of in an anecdotal sort of way, I suppose. Did they frequently get away?
Yes. A number were sunk, a fair number a lot of damage was done to them, but I think more of a deterrent than anything else, and the fact that I'm sure it deterred them, well, I know it deterred them from their object of getting further down the coast and attacking the Allied shipping and resupplying parts of Northern Europe at that stage of the game. In anecdotal form, I'm sure there had been, because the MTB people were very colourful characters, generally speaking. The ones that we carried, one I can remember by name, my name was Lieutenant Commander Barge, an appropriate name for a person who ran coastal forces, I suppose, was a very colourful individual, and a reputation throughout all coastal forces of being a character. And I imagine he was with us too. Well, I can't remember any specific anecdotes that time. It seemed to be work and work and work. even when we got back in the Harriet, as far as the officers were concerned, we were busy. It was one of my subsidiary jobs at the time was the captain secretary and the paymaster. And so whenever we got in the Harriet, I was usually busy trying to catch up on mail and correspondence and various bits and pieces like that. And it was a period of extreme interest and busy and long hours. We were given a great deal of freedom by the captain, who, being, if I remember, in the ops room as a weapons controller and a relatively young man, I had authority to, as long as I had identified our contact myself as being an enemy boat, to engage it with whatever weapons I could bring to bear from the ship without normally going through the commanding officer to, say, request permission to open fire or something like that. His instructions to us were, if you positively identify any boat or an enemy ship, you will engage it. And because he would coach us from the operations room by watching the radar and saying, the U-boats now are bearing so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so at a range of, so we knew approximately what ranges they were at. But once a good melee had started of MTVs and U-boats, it wasn't always easy to tell whether it was one of our own or one of theirs that broke out of a group of shipping to come towards us. Occasionally they were U-boats. Oh, we sank a couple with our own gunfire, and our MTBs certainly got a few. One of the people was engaged in this sort of thing at the time. He never actually came out with us. But I believe he did in other British ships. It was a Canadian MTB officer by the name of Tony Law, who also became later on one of the official Canadian war artists, and who is now, I believe, the artist in residence at St. Mary's University in Halifax. Mm-hmm. He was a very well-known MTB officer of those that time. It is a very interesting period, and I think, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of... In fact, I'm sure that that was the basis of the system that we all now use of controlling and fighting our engagements from the operations room. And also the break of tradition of getting the captain from the command position on the bridge
to the ops room.
That was a real break in tradition, because for years and years and years, the navies had always had the mental picture of the captain standing gallantly on his bridge as the ship went down underneath him, or engaging the battle, or controlling the battle. And that lasted until, he stayed on that, until the E-Day. In fact, we were at sea off the Dutch coast of the E-Day, continued a patrol on May the 9th, and they were detailed to go up into Hamburg on either May the 10th or May the 11th. We were the first ship into Hamburg after Hamburg had been liberated, and only literally just a couple of days after the end of the war, which was quite fascinating, to go into a spot like that. And of course, remember, because Hamburg is one of the cities that is very, very heavily damaged. To get the very, very cold, a terribly proper reception by the German people. They did nothing that could be considered to be incorrect, but coldly polite. And you felt a complete alien in their group. I suppose we were there for about a week or so, and it was at the request, I gather, of General Montgomery to quickly establish a naval presence in that port. And Montgomery himself came on board shortly after we arrived and did a quick inspection of the ship, I think to establish his presence in the area and let our sailors know that he was there, and that the British Army was in pretty firm control of that part of the world. And from that, we, this would be now towards, I guess, towards the middle of May, came down and picked up, went through the canal into Kiel, and from Kiel back into the river that Hamburg's on. I've forgotten the name of it now. It doesn't matter. But picked up from Kiel and Cuxhaven and Wilhelmshaven. I can't remember the number now, I suppose, but somewhere between about 8 and 12 submarines that had surrendered and escorted them around the north of Scotland to an anchorage in Loch Ewe, where the British were collecting quite a few of the surrendered U-boats and assembling them there. That was an eerie feeling, too, of steaming along at night with two lines of submarines trailing along behind you.
You were actually towing them?
No, they were steaming on their own power. There was a a British body on each of them.
A body by me? You mean one person?
Yes, one person, as a form of liaison. And we spoke to him by radio, and they were picked to people who, in most cases, could speak some German, who could relay instructions. And of course, conversely, there were a number of the Germans could still speak English reasonably, spoke English sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
But to steam along with these two lines sort of formed up behind you, submarines, wondering really quite how honest they were. Because we were a totally vulnerable target at that stage. They must have had the torpedoes withdrawn.
Defused or something.
They could easily also have pulled a plug and submerged, and when woken up in the morning and found only one less than you thought you had there. But they all, as it happened, trundled along very docilely and followed us all the way to Loch Ewe. We dropped them off there. And it was that stage, and I seriously started my search to get transferred from the Royal Navy volunteer to the Royal Canadian Naval Volunteer. If you remember, I told you earlier that I'd applied on several occasions and hadn't made it. Well, I thought this was about the opportune time to start again, so I applied, I would think, in about late May or early June of that year of 45, a transfer to the Canadian Volunteer Reserve, and got the word in early September that one, the Royal Navy would release me, and secondly, the Canadian Volunteer Reserve would pick me up. And so I transferred in early September of 45 and was immediately posted up to join one of our brand new destroyers that was building on the Clyde, the Crusader, and commissioned her and brought her out to Canada. She did her trials and workups, things like that, in the Portland area in southern England in very late 45, and arrived back at Esquimalt in early 46. I think we spent Christmas, I think, between the Azores on the way out and Jamaica. I think we arrived around here about the 10th, 15th of January, 46.
If I could just backtrack in the small amount of tape we have left, what was it? What did Hamburg look like as you saw it? As you said, it was heavily bombed.
A pile of rubble. And of course, the death was so soon that very little would appear to have been done to try and clean it up or to reassemble the rubble. The harbour was devastated. Many of the ships that had been lying in the harbour were either very severely damaged at their piers or were sunk at their piers. The port, I would say, had ceased to function, certainly as a seaport. And nothing was getting in or out. Large U-boat bases still there. Builders' yards, some of which were submarines completed, some were submarines still sort of in the building stage, but I think it was virtually a stop.
Was the people themselves, if the city was that, they Was there obvious evidence of people starving or going without
no,
the basic...
Not from our aspect at all. I certainly never saw that. We were restricted in where we were allowed to travel around the city. We did a certain amount of traveling around, just out of sheer curiosity, I suppose, as much as anything else, as the young people at that stage. I saw no evidence of that. I would have said the morale of the Germans looked pretty good from what you could see. I said before, our treatment was terribly formally and coldly correct. They would accede to any single thing we asked of them or demanded of.
But only to the letter, not to the...
Yes. The one thing I do remember vividly, and it's not very historical, was the absolute beauty of the river on going up to Hamburg. Even at the end of the war, the magnificent estates and the green swaths of lawns and gardens coming down at the river's edge. And to me, this was an absolute contrast to the British rivers that I had known well, the Mersey and the Thames and areas like that, where it was totally industrialized right down to the water's edge of smoke, soot, and a grimy look to the British port area. But to go up the river into Hamburg, it was magnificent scenery, even in that day and age. And not a great deal of sign of damage in the old estates and the little ancestral homes as you went up the river until you got to the port itself. Cuxhaven, we were in also, it didn't appear to be anything like as badly damaged. And the people in Cuxhaven, I just said, were much warmer. As the cold reception, cold correct, the Cuxhaven people seemed to us to be trying to make an effort to get to know us a little and be a little more sort of receptive. But again, that may be as a result of the fact that the city hadn't been as badly damaged as Hamburg was. On your last bit of tape, though, having lived in England, having been in Liverpool and in London in some of the heavier raids, where London was so badly damaged and Liverpool so badly damaged, that I had no, at that stage, I'm not sure you know, I had no sympathy whatsoever.